Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What lies between an artist's vision, that explosive moment of inspiration, and the execution that transforms the idea into reality? Performance artist Philippe Pettit first got the notion to skywalk between the Twin Towers before they were even built, when he was just a high school kid in France, reading an article about plans for New York's World Trade Center before ground had even been broken. For years, he was obsessed with what couldn't be done.
Impossible. It's clearly impossible, not only to walk across this, I have probably hardly thought of it, but to bring almost like a ton of equipment secretly, to rig a wire for hours, to guideline it. It's clearly out of human scale. But something in me pulls me toward touching it.
It took more than 6 years and a group of similarly passionate disciples for Pettit to dazzle the world with his dance on the wire 1,300 feet above New York. And it took another 3 decades for Pettit to allow a director to make the story into a feature-length film. Earlier this year, Man on Wire took top documentary awards at the Sundance Film Festival, and it's showing now at the Angelika Film Centers in Dallas and Plano. Director James Marsh is on the line from Copenhagen to talk about the project and its captivating subject. James, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You were just a little boy when Philippe Pettit crossed the wire. Do you have any memories at all of the news coverage?
I was a little boy in a very remote part of England, so I don't have any direct memory of it at that time. I then, as an adult, moved to New York, and it's one of those stories that you just hear about living in New York City. I was living there for the last 14 years.
And so
I encountered it as a kind of folklore story, a kind of memory, if you like, that the city had retained since 1974 when Philippe actually did the walk. And that story again became, I think, a bit more alive after the Twin Towers were destroyed. So that's how I first encountered it, just living in the city and absorbing that story indirectly.
It is an interesting thing to think about the Twin Towers in a capacity that has nothing to do with the tragedy. Living in New York at the time that you were working on the film, did it worry you that people wouldn't be able to sort of get over this overwhelming block of the towers being something that makes people sad now?
Well, it did concern me, I think, and it also concerned me that the towers themselves had been defined only by this devastating destruction and loss of life. And, of course, they had a life before that destruction, and that's sort of the big fact of that. It has defined how we perceive them now. So I was worried about the timing of the film in a way, but just felt that the story itself was so magical. It's like a kind of real-life fairy tale, someone doing something that's physically and sort of almost mentally impossible, if you like. But we were sort of relieved when the film first screened in the city. It played at the Tribeca Film Festival, and we had, you know, a sort of hardcore New York audience there. And people, I think, were very moved by the film and not, I don't think, overly demoralized or overly connected to the tragedy of those buildings. And perhaps the timing of the film, you know, a few years on from that is quite good in that respect. But of course, it's a big defining fact of the film that the buildings are not there, but one which we don't in any way refer to or investigate. It felt very important to me that we make a distinction. We're telling this, you know, really beautiful story about these buildings to try and, you know, be in the moment for that 90 minutes of the film's duration. And because Philippe had the idea, as you mentioned in your intro, to do this walk even before they were constructed, it allowed us to show footage of the buildings actually being constructed and going up alongside this sort of, you know, deluded and brilliant ambition he had to actually conquer them in this beautiful way. So in the film, you know, the film gets you, I think, to a different place with those buildings, I hope quite quickly. And so far, I think people have definitely responded that way to it.
He talks in the film about being sort of irritated by the quintessentially American question of why he did this, because for him, why doesn't matter. And it's interesting because it's not something that you explore in the film exactly. And I'm wondering if that's because there is no explanation for wanting to do something like this or because it's simple enough for all of us to find on our own.
Well, for me, not being American, but having lived in America, it was a question that, you know, for when I started working on the film, I thought, well, you know, but when I started really understanding the story, and hopefully the story that we've told in the film is understandable on this level, it doesn't need any further explanation. You know, if you regard what Philippe does as some kind of performance, which I do, it's not just a stunt or he doesn't show that he can just cross across one time. He performs on the wire and does eight crossings and is up there for about 45 minutes. It's a performance. It's a thing of great sort of heart-stopping beauty if you're the surprise audience below. And that, for me, was just a justification in itself and needed no further explanation or no further why. And you know, people are looking for, either did he do it for money or did he do it to sponsor, you know, something, or what was in it for him? And quite honestly, it was just a performance he absolutely passionately wanted to do. And these, at that time, the highest buildings in the world, and they're parallel and they're twin towers, and they need to be joined, he thinks, by this tightrope wire that he's going to put across. So there was never any question for me as why he did it. It felt that it just justified itself on that level of human beauty, if you like. It's like what we wouldn't question of why a painter feels compelled to paint something. That's just a given. And I think I just cherished it as a sort of ephemeral, magical performance that was a gift to New York. And I think people received it that way. But, of course, there's a sort of, you know, is this question, why would someone do that? And I think that in the film, you get a glimpse of the personality involved, the drive and the ambition of this man, and also his peculiar kind of sensibility that does explain his psychology. But what we don't do is sort of have endless speculations about his childhood or have any, you know, psychological sort of commentary on what's going on. It's an action film, essentially, and we show how he did it and the choices he makes and the people that he brought to this project and how they respond to him and how they regard what he's doing. And he gets people, you know, he doesn't really know very well, to sign up and do this crazy thing with him, which is very dangerous, and not all of them, of course, see it through. So the bigger why, I think available for the audience to understand on whatever level they want to.
How far along in your mind was the project when you and Philippe first sat down together and talked about this?
Well, I was aware of the walk itself as this, what appeared to be one of these great sort of New York sort of moments, these great New York stunts, if you like, and there are a bunch of them out there. But I then read Philippe's, he wrote a memoir called To Reach the Clouds, which is his very subjective and very, you know, personal account of how he achieved what he achieved. And that book is absolutely captivating. And I then teamed up with a producer in London, and we spent quite a bit of time courting Philippe, if that's the right word to use, and it probably is the right word to use. And we had one rather awkward telephone encounter, and I begged him in a letter that we would meet in person. And meanwhile, Simon Chin, the producer, was trying to option the book, and that was all going on in tandem. And once we met, we got on very well, because I wasn't the first person to approach him to make a film by any means. I was the first person to say to him, well, let's collaborate, let's do this together, and I'm interested in knowing your ideas and taking my starting point from the book. And so he responded very well to that, and he's a very mischievous kind of character as well, and he picked my pocket on that first meeting. And generally, was I think he wanted to see whether I was up for some mischief as well, and clearly I was. So it wasn't easy to persuade him, because he'd hold on to this story for 30 years. He'd turned down many more lucrative kind of offers that he'd had. But I think he liked the approach that I had. And I said, I want to make it like a heist film, like a crime film. He loved that idea too, because for him that's what it was. One of my first ideas, maybe the only idea I had, was to structure the film much more like a kind of a thriller or a heist film than a kind of, you know, responsible PBS-style documentary where you have commentary and you kind of, you generally, do it in a fairly detached way. I wanted to make it exciting and thrilling in the way that the walk it was, and to try and get into the suspense of this adventure, because what they have to do, as you mentioned up front, is impossible. You have to get a team of people into both towers, not just one tower. You have to break in disguise with all this very suspicious-looking equipment, including a bow and arrow, which they use for reasons that you'll have to go and see the film to find out. And they've got this grappling gear and this enormous cable, and they have to get into both towers and have to get up to the roof, all undetected by security guards who were patrolling those buildings, particularly at the top, when the top at that time was just still being finished up. So they had a lot of guards were wandering around on the top of those buildings, people stealing building materials and the like from it. So it's a very difficult task, and it's being done not by hardened criminals, but by sort of, bohemians in New York City. And so what you have is essentially a comedy of errors. When they go in there, obviously they have detailed plans and they're in disguise, and it all starts to go terribly wrong. And again, it has elements of comedy, but the framework for the film is a heist, and you see them. The film opens with the heist unfolding, and then we start flashing back to some of the events and the people and how they got involved in all this, much like the film Reservoir Dogs, if you've seen it, which has that kind of structure to it. So it's unusual for a documentary to use what is essentially movie techniques, but it felt so right for this story and so right for Philippe's sort of mentality. So the film is more like a heist film than a documentary.
Just getting to the top with that ton of equipment was going to be a challenge, and one they hadn't entirely figured out. They were going to have to carry stuff up 20 flights when they got to a certain level. But then, as we'll hear right here, they lucked out.
The operator of the freight elevator had not completely heard the foreman shouting 80 second floor, and it was clearly on our delivery bill and on all the package. He asked to the group, what floor again?
Right there. I think this is it.
And I said clearly, 104. So, okay, whatever, watch your hands, and clang, the gate clanged shut. Now we are in a plywood box, a temporary freight elevator, going all the way up. And it's dark, it's a travel toward heaven. And the darkness becomes gray, and I see a square of gray that becomes lighter. I see a square of light, it is the sky, we're getting there, and we're arriving just a few floors below the roof with all our equipment.
That is a cut from Man on Wire, the documentary directed by James Marsh that's now playing at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and Plano. We have James Marsh here with us to talk about the film. You know, you hear that clip, James, and Philippe is so passionate about what he's doing. And it's very interesting in the piece because he's this amazing study in contrast. He's sort of hyperkinetic on the ground and moving 100 miles an hour and talkative, and his thoughts go in every direction. But then on that wire, when we see him there, he is entirely laser-focused on that thin little piece of metal cable.
Yes, it's interesting that. And the film respects, I guess, that rhythm, too. The film gallops along and gets its energy, I think, from Philippe's storytelling. And yet, as you say, on the wire, he knows what the stakes are, and who wouldn't know? But he knows more than anyone else would ever know what the stakes are there. It's his life he's carrying across there. And the kind of intensity of the concentration that you see is absolutely extraordinary. So it becomes a very still kind of place for him. And he feels, when we've talked personally about this, it's the place where he most belongs, and no one else can be there with him. It's a very solitary and beautiful space that he's on. And clearly he actually enjoys doing it too. And one of the most amazing photographs of all is one that's actually out of focus, but you see he's taken his maybe third or fourth step on the wire and he smiles. And it's just amazing to see that he's enjoying this. It's not just fear or facing down fear. It's active enjoyment. But of course, as a human being, as a character in the film, you see this man who gallops in his head all the time and can't keep still. We had a terrible job interviewing him because he didn't obey the rules of interviews. Not that there are rules, but he wouldn't sit down and just be asked questions. He would get up and act out the whole story for us, which some people might get worried about. But I just embraced it. I mean, I thought, okay, well, this is going to be great. We have to change all our technical plans here, but if my subject wants to tell the story this way and he wants to run around the room and climb up the walls and run out the door, which he did at one point, then that's fine too. And so he actually performs the story for us to some extent, and it's sort of anarchic and chaotic and messy, but there's a real energy to it. And I think that energy you see in the interview is the energy that he had at the time that allowed him to do this amazing physical feat, but also to endure 8 months of planning and setbacks. And it's not just... it's not an easy ride, even before they get in that night to the buildings.
Just a second, James. We're going to take a break. James Marsh is with us. He's the director of Man on Wire. You've just heard him discussing the subject of that film, Philippe Pettit. We'll be back in a minute, and you could join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is director James Marsh. His documentary Man on Wire earned top documentary honors at the Sundance Film Festival this year. You can see it now at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and in Plano. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Before the break, James, you were talking about how Philippe Pettit does not follow the rules. I'm sure you had the set all nicely lit and you were sort of ready for him to tell his story, and he kept jumping up and acting things out. It must have been challenging for you, too, knowing that this is a story that he's told probably weekly at least for the past 30-something years. Did you have any moment of thinking that you wanted him to tell it in a different way than his sort of standard thing that he's done all this time?
Well, actually, it's true. You know, he's obviously dined out on that one for a long time, and it's sort of, you feel that he's got a sort of way of telling it, but we gave him a glass of wine or two beforehand. I'm not sure I'm allowed to say this on NPR, but we did.
Oh, we like wine at NPR.
I figured you might. And he's French, and that's part of their civilization and culture. And I did indeed, cut him off and actually sort of try. I tried to kind of make it dynamic the way I was conducting the interview. But what makes it, I think, the film, in a sense, much more interesting is that there's a kaleidoscope of narratives in the film. It's not just Philippe's point of view. What we did, we managed to track down every single person who was involved in this plot and get their version of events. And what's interesting about that is that all the most unbelievable parts of the story completely checked out. So the things that you think, well, maybe that's a bit mythical, or maybe that's been improved by the telling of it, no, they were the things that absolutely everyone agreed on. What they didn't agree on, of course, was the time and the kind of emotions that were involved. And there was a group of people that came around Philippe, two French people he'd worked with before on two previous illegal walks, an Australian who came to the beginning of the plot, and then his girlfriend Annie from France came over. And there's an attempt to do it before they actually get to do it, which falls apart, and it falls apart because the people involved think he's going to die up there, and they back off. So all the people in that first version of the plot are interviewed in the film, and then there's a second version of the plot which becomes the successful version, and that involves a couple of much more unreliable Americans who are sort of feckless and not quite sort of up to the task, and one of them, neither of them survive. They survive physically, none of them actually survive the actual night in the towers. And so we've got all those versions of the story. So we have these parallel narratives. And, of course, because there's a team in one tower and a team in the other tower, we've got two different dramas unfolding in parallel as well. So I think that the film opens up quite nicely to these different points of view. And, of course, there's a great deal of antagonism generated by this group of people together at that time. So a lot of those passions come out again as well. So there's quite a lot of disagreement about how they're going to do this and people falling out with each other. And so that all becomes part of the story too, the human drama, if you like, of this, which is not inconsiderable given that you've got a group of disparate people involved in doing something that's clearly very difficult, if not impossible, and also, in one level, completely pointless, if you like. There's a lot of human sort of emotions involved too, and we have those in the film, and you do see quite a lot of disagreement amongst the people involved. But as I said, what's interesting is that some of the most preposterous parts of the story are absolutely verified by everyone involved.
Yeah, there's this one amazing scene when they get up into the tower, I guess on their second attempt, the one that was successful, they have to hide because there's a guard there that they weren't expecting to be there. So they pull themselves under this tarp. And perhaps because of the couple of glasses of wine that you gave him, when Philippe is describing this, he almost sounds as if he's right back in that moment.
So here we are under the tarp, frozen to death. I don't have to murmur to Jean-François, don't move. He feels it in our body connection. And now the guard comes. Has he seen us? Has he heard us? Has he seen the tarp move? But the guard comes and leans against the structure, and he seems to be a foot away. And I hear the cracking of his walkie-talkie, and I hear he takes a cigarette. And the sound grows up now of the lighter and of this first puff, the burning of the extremity of the cigarette. And the he seems to be almost leaning on my ear. So we are, frozen. We don't breathe.
Such a great cut. And I think as we listen to that and the way that you've recreated it in the film, we as an audience don't breathe.
I hope so. That's certainly the intention, is to put you where Philippe is putting himself. And in a sense, he's a bit like a method actor, that he reconnects very, very fully with his emotions. And in fact, what's interesting that other people do as well, there's another man under the top with him, of course, that he mentions in passing, called Jean-Francois, we interview, and of course he's there, and he gives his view of being entangled for 3 or 4 hours on this, under this top, on a beam that looks down to a drop of 200 feet. So they're literally stuck on this sort of narrow beam together, you know, entangled, these two Frenchmen. And of course, someone else was also in that room with them, who came with them, into another American, and he's actually fled the building at this point because he can't see himself being under the tarp with these two sweaty Frenchmen for hours on end, and he's freaked out completely. And also, he's also owned up to smoking a lot of marijuana before he's done this, so he's, you know, peculiarly paranoid, I guess, as well. So all in all, this drama is going on. It's sort of comic, but also what makes it, I think, you know, for the audience and for me as a storyteller or a filmmaker, is that they so believe in the objective. They so want to do this. And so, you know, the comedy comes from their passions being endlessly thwarted by these setbacks. But they absolutely do want to do this passionately. And that everyone sort of is able to kind of endorse that. And if those that don't, of course, want to do it, have to flee. And that's what that night does. You know, it sorts out those who are really going to do it to those that aren't quite fully there.
And one really interesting detail about this is that another reason that the guy who left was because that beam was so high up, and it was over an elevator shaft, and the idea of that amount of height freaked him out.
Indeed. I mean, the fact was they were on this narrow 6-inch beam, and had they, you know, fallen, they would have fallen to their doom. And what's interesting, that the same thing is happening in the other tower, that the two people who go into that tower addressed as businessmen, they've gone in as actually architects. They've got an architect's tube with them, which carries the bow and arrow. And they've got caught on a high floor as well, again by a security guard wandering around. And they're hiding behind a pile of boxes in business suits, you know, on an unfinished floor of the Twin Towers. And there's no real good explanation if you're discovered in a couple of men in suits hiding
in a
behind
box.
You know, it's like, how are you going to explain it? You know, so had either of them been caught at that time, it would have all been over, and all those months of planning and for Philippe, years of dreaming would have been for nothing. And so, you know, the stakes are extremely high, and I think that the suspense of the film comes from, I think, you know, that we begin to like the characters involved and really want them to succeed. And there's a suggestion they might have done, because obviously they're all still alive. But how they succeed and the business of them pulling this off really is very, very surprising, and that, I think, gives the film its tension.
My guest is James Marsh. He's director of a film called Man on Wire. It's playing now at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and Plano. Let's take a call at 1-800-933-5372, and that's Judy in Dallas. Hello, Judy.
Hi. I saw the movie at the Dallas Museum of Art. It was excellent, excellent. But I wasn't clear on the ending. One of his team members, the white-haired Frenchman who said that Philippe had asked him to do it again, and he said no, he was not going to help him again. And then their friendship ended. And I wasn't sure if the friendship ended because everybody was just exhausted of supporting him and him being the center of attention and everybody reaping nothing, or was it because just people go their different ways. I didn't understand the end of that wonderful friendship.
Well, I think you actually described it very well. It's a bit of both, but probably more the former than the latter. I think that the business of doing this, it was so difficult, and it stretched that friendship to breaking point. They didn't really agree on how they were going to do it. And you see in the film there's several scenes where they're openly disagreeing about the manner of this. And they've been friends for a long time, and I think that the stress of doing what they did caused that friendship to kind of conclude with the achievement that the friendship had produced, which was this magnificent walk. And I did leave it a little bit ambiguous because I wanted you, and as you have actually done, actually very perceptively, to put it together a bit for yourself. And I mean, perhaps that's a little bit frustrating for some people in the audience, but I felt that the clues were all there, and your speculation was entirely right, that this friendship ended through the fracturing, you know, that was created by this enormous effort. I think there was also an element of people going their separate ways. Philippe, you know, was an instant celebrity in New York. He stayed in New York. The other people were literally, you know, they were deported back to France, those that were caught and arrested with him. So that put another sort of, you know, conclusion to it, just geographically, that Philippe stayed in America and lost touch with his girlfriend too, who also in the film is very sort of broken up by this as well. And so at the end of the film, we do see these very uncomfortable emotions coming out. And in a sense, you know, what we've seen in the film is like a real-life fairy tale, but it is ultimately based on real life. And real life is messy, and relationships don't survive. And there's no real happy ever after in this kind of story, I don't think. You know, but inevitably, people move on, they get older. And so I think some of it, his tears at the end are for a lost innocence as well, as something they achieved when they were young that maybe they couldn't do now. And it's all very complicated. But to answer your question, you know, you answered it actually very well for yourself, and I hope I've answered it a bit more fully for you.
What I find very striking, James, is that of all the people in the film, Philippe loves looking back on this memory, and he clearly enjoys the attention that he gets from the story, but it doesn't seem to have changed his life to the same extent, amazingly, that it seems to have psychologically affected everyone else around him.
That's a really interesting thought, and I think you're probably right about that. I think for Philippe is one of these people that was born to be a star in his own mind and did everything he could to become someone. You know, if you do what he does, you're asking people to look at you. You're asking for them to look at you and examine you and enjoy you as a physical presence on a tightrope, and he's a performer. And so in his own mind, he was always a celebrity. I think for the people around him, it was, you know, a very unique event for them all, particularly his French friends. And they've been involved in an earlier illegal walk in Notre Dame, and we glimpse that in the film. You see how that walk, you know, very briefly was put together, and the same people are involved. And I think for them, this was the crowning achievement of their young lives, and when they were fearless and reckless and able to imagine the impossible. So I think looking back on it, you know, it's kind of bittersweet for them. This was the thing that they achieved, and I think it, you know, it stayed with them in a ways that Philippe, of course, moved on very quickly and did other walks and became somewhat of a kind of public personality through his walks and his just general, you know, sort of impish presence in the world. So I think you're right. I think it did mean to the people around him something a bit more than it did to him. And that's an odd observation, but I think it's the correct one. It's certainly one that I think, you know, I felt at the end of the film itself, end of the process of making the film.
You have some extraordinary vintage footage from the time that they were preparing for all this, and then, of course, from the event itself. Did you and Simon Chin know about this footage before you proposed the project to Philippe?
Well, no, we didn't. It was one of those amazing discoveries. And Philippe, of course, wouldn't give it up or even mention it when we first started meeting. It was, prove yourself, young man, you know, before I give you what I know you want to see. So I would go and see him. He lives in upstate New York. I would go on a fairly regular basis. I would spend time with him, listen to him, you know, get the story out of him. And gradually I was given little treats to keep me interested, like, you know, literally treats. I was given some blueprints from the Twin Towers that he'd stolen early on. And then he then took me to his little lock-up garage and showed me 9 cans of unprocessed film, which purported to be film shot of him in France, you know, training for this event with the people who we see on camera in our film. And so I then processed that film, and I had, you know, about 2 hours of beautifully shot 60mm film that showed Philippe and the people most involved with him in meadows in France, in sun-dappled sort of trees, you know, rehearsing for this and planning it out and discussing how they were going to do it. And we see various, you know, problems being solved in this training camp, which is what he calls it, not least how to get the wire from one building to another. It's an enormous problem. How do you get a very heavy steel cable across this void? You can't just throw it across. You know, it's not possible. And we see that being worked on in France. And this is all being recorded and filmed by Philippe and a little crew that are around him just for these few days he's there. So this was an amazing gift to have that and to see the squabbling and to see the model he built and the rigging that he was going to do on the building. So, yes, it was a wonderful gift to be given as a filmmaker to have, you know, moving footage of all this stuff and to see the people in there, you know, as young men and young woman, Annie, who's Philippe's girlfriend, you see in the film, you see in this footage too, and they're all so irresistibly French, and there's one Australian, in fact, involved too. But what this footage gives you is the absolute spirit of the adventure, which is literally the fun that was being had as well. It's serious business, but you see them, you know, literally giving each other piggybacks in meadows and laughing a lot and then squabbling a lot. And it's an amazing archive. And it becomes the emotional center of the film. It becomes how we get to know these people at that time. And, of course, they're all wearing dungarees and you know, period costumes, if you like. So, you know, it was a and I saw this, I was just blown away when I saw this. And that began to become the center of the film, and I think, you know, the film that is it's an emotional center is this brilliant footage where we see all this stuff happening for real.
It really is amazing stuff. When I first saw it, in fact, I thought it was a recreation, and then the faces are so obviously the people that are involved.
Well, some people still do, in fact, and it's a film that unfortunately, you know, just play fast and loose with those kinds of ideas in filmmaking, where you just want to tell the story as best you can. But that is all obviously genuine footage. And I, you know, did other reconstructions, particularly of the crime narrative. The, you know, the break-in, the heist, if you like, is all a series of reconstructions that I filmed and scripted, and they all kind of blend together. I think, you know, that you can argue about the propriety of it, but the idea for me was just to put on a really good show as well, and just give people a really gripping and thrilling movie that was reflecting this gripping and thrilling real life story. And so hopefully purists will forgive me for being so, you know, kind of not adventurous, you know, shameless, if you like, with the way I tell the story.
Well, and when you watch it, you know, you talk about them being irresistibly French. They're also irresistibly young.
They
sort of remember that time in
20s.
Your life.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely that.
And the only one who sort of looks the same and moves with the same energy, lo these 34 years later, is Philippe.
Of course, you know, he still is, you know, he's now a very experienced tightrope walker. At that time, he was still, I think, you know, proving it himself. And he's retained a physical grace and a sort of just also a kind of impish spirit that, you know, to this day, he looks and feels like the same kind of character. And, you know, again, he also lives his life that way. His girlfriend says something very, I think, very appropriate. She says, well, every day for him is like a work of art. And that sounds pretentious in any other context, but for him it really is, you know. It's what can I create today? What can I do today? What fun can be had? What, you know, what extreme can I go to today? And that's, I've been around him a lot, and that's what he's like every day. You know, he's relentless and exhausting at the same time.
James Marsh is with us. He's the director of the award-winning documentary Man on Wire, which is playing now at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and Plano. We'll be back with more of the story, more with James, in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director James Marsh. His Sundance Award-winning documentary Man on Wire about Philippe Petit's crossing of a wire strung between the Twin Towers in 1974 is playing now at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and Plano. If you want to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Another thing that is really striking about Philippe's personality is that for him, he's aware that this is, of course, illegal and that some people will frown upon what he does. But as we'll hear right here, he seems to have this extraordinary joy that comes simply from sort of playing this cat and mouse game.
As a child, have you ever played hide and seek in a park and take refuge behind a giant tree trunk and a policeman comes to the roof, and then your companion comes, circle the trunk, he walks, you walk, he stops, you stop. The man start turning around this obstacle in the center of my tower, and I turn around on the side diametrically opposed. This little pas de deux could go on forever until one of you turn around and bump into each other. Well, this is exactly what happened. He turns, I turn. He stops, I stops. He go on, I go on. Now, of course, if he would have turned around, oops, hide and seek.
What I love, this is one of those clips where you talk, James, about him standing up and moving around through all these interviews. So what you've done here is sort of intercut, it looks like, two examples of him telling the story, and you let him tell it as two different characters almost. He's in a different outfit, he's standing in one and sitting in the other, or moving in a different way, and it works beautifully.
It probably works better on screen than it does on radio. But yes, what you're seeing in that clip is you're seeing Philippe hiding behind a curtain, peering out at you, telling you the story, and then intercutting that with a slightly more restrained telling of the story in a chair. And that's when we began to develop that idea. You know, after a few hours of doing the interview in this sort of crazy way, I decided to actually do it a little bit more carefully and try and understand, you know, that certain scenes should be done playfully that way. So that's what you're seeing, as it were, on the radio, is that sort of intercut between a man sort of acting out something behind a curtain and putting his head on the curtain and telling you what's going on, and a slightly more restrained version of the same man telling you the story more clearly. And that we did that several times in the film, just to kind of, in a sense, just to show you the performer and the man at the same time.
He has said in a very complimentary way about you that you spent a lot of time during the making of the film arguing with each other about how it should be. And I'm wondering if that was a challenge for you to be working with an artist who does view his life as a work of art, wanting his own story told his own way.
Well, indeed, and that was something that, you know, at a certain point, you know, that I have a responsibility to myself and indeed to the audience I want for the film to make sure that the film itself hangs together and is structured in a certain kind of way. And so at certain times I did feel like I was protecting the story from his ideas about telling it. And we did have, as you gathered, you know, quite passionate disagreements at times, particularly towards the end of the process when Philippe had seen what I got up to. And you know, he at one point chased me around the room and was very angry with me.
he physically chased you around the room.
He literally chased me around the room, and I had to kind of run out. So yes, he's a very passionate man, and it wasn't. But the thing is, we're sort of like ice and fire. He's French, I'm British. He's a very passionate, very voluble man. I'm much more sort of restrained, and so it was quite a good blend in that respect. And the thing was, it was always about the work. It was never personal. It was always about how best to do this. And you know, I'd made quite a few films already. I do know a little bit about filmmaking. So, but nonetheless, there was quite a lot of quite passionate disagreement. And I think the point is that it created something that was better. I mean, he was challenged the film a lot and challenged me a lot. And that makes you very sure of what you're doing. If you're being challenged, you have to better make sure that you can justify and explain and stand by the work you're doing. So it made the film better. So our disagreements during the making of the film were very good for the film. And at the end of the process, he very graciously, you know, let it go and said, okay, it's your film. And he saw it with a group of people, and the people he saw it with were very, very taken with the film, and he enjoyed it through other people's eyes. And now he's very fond of the film and thinks it's really caught the spirit of what the whole story was about, and has supported the film, you know, in festivals, and is very happy with it. But you know, to get to that point, there was quite a lot of aggravation, shall we say.
Well, it sounds like your relationship with him in many ways paralleled the relationship he had with his close friend, with whom he had a falling out after it was all over, who was sort of trying to save him from himself.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and it might perhaps that, you know, there's something, you know, universally true about that, is that people do tend to reproduce styles of relationships with each other, and I was a collaborator of sorts. He was the star of the show, yet he needed me and what I knew practically to tell the story. In fact, at a certain point, I just took over, which you couldn't do if you were Jean-Louis or some of the people involved in the adventure at the World Trade Center, because you know, Philippe's the man on the wire. But you're right, I think it was kind of similar. It didn't end the same way, or not so far anyway.
I am not particularly acrophobic, but I have to tell you that the scenes where he's sort of leaning over the edge of the World Trade Center are just dizzying. What sort of thought did you give to the way you would approach height and showing height on a medium as small as a movie screen when you have thousands of feet involved in the real thing?
Well, I had an advantage and a disadvantage because I'm absolutely terrified of heights. And so the story meant so much more to me, or was so much more intensely felt, if you like, at the point when I first read it. Oh my God, how on earth could you do this? And I'm absolutely terrified. So I think quite a lot of that fear is expressed in the film, and so I'm able, I guess, to try and find ways of showing you and people, showing how I felt about the nature of vertigo and the nature of the exposure in that kind of, you know, top of the World Trade Center. And so, in that respect, I think some of it, the reason you felt a little, you know, a little nervous was because I felt a whole lot more nervous and was possibly able to show you things. But what I did do, there's one special effect shot in the whole film, and we didn't have very much money, but I put all the money into that one shot, which shows you a look down at a crucial point in the film just before he's about to do the walk. And I think when I've seen the film with an audience, it does tend to kind of up the ante and make people properly understand the nature of the void that he's about to confront. It's not just a bit high up. It's as high as you can humanly go, I think, at that time. And so it is really stunning and mind-boggling. And then Philippe very beautifully describes the moment when he lets his foot go from the building onto the wire, when there's no turning back, essentially. And it's a very beautiful moment in the film, and I think that really helps you get there. He really feels that moment again, I think, when he's talking about it. So I think you really do understand that this is terrifying and inhuman, and yet all those things make it sublimely beautiful as well.
We have an email from Bill in Dallas who writes, "Do you think that a similar stunt could even be pulled off today? I would fully expect law enforcement to not be able to smile on the achievement and to shut the perpetrator in prison."
Well, I think, you know, Philippe would say nothing is impossible, and he proved it. But I think it's a whole lot more impossible, shall we say, now, because unfortunately the world has changed dramatically, you know, in emerging directly from the destruction of those buildings, and the world that we live in is to some extent a creation of that. When you go to an airport now, it's very different. And that's true of anything like Philippe was trying to do. I think it would be much harder. And you couldn't really be a group of dodgy foreigners hanging around a building with cameras taking photographs. You certainly couldn't bring a bow and arrow through JFK Airport and get away with it. You know, I think liquids are not allowed, so a bow and arrow certainly wouldn't be allowed in your suitcase. And they did that very openly. You know, there was no problem bringing a bow and arrow into America at that time. So, yes, I think it is, unfortunately, a lot harder. And it's because we've embraced, you know, certain fears that have been generated and given to us, and that's one aspect of the post 9/11 world I deeply regret, living in New York and seeing how we've all submitted ourselves to fear, and that's, you know, one of the reasons why I think the film is kind of poignant. It invokes an era that certainly wasn't any more innocent, and in some respects was quite a lot less innocent. The 70s in New York was really not a great time for the city, but at the same time you see that this kind of impossible, beautiful thing is available, and you can imagine it, and you can dream up something like this. And, you know, the authorities responded in kind. He was arrested, and they were very angry at him. The police were, and particularly he'd been taunting them for 45 minutes on that wire. But eventually, they all calmed down and say, "Well, guess what? No one's been harmed here. We'll punish you by making you do another walk for us for the kids of the city," and that's what he's punished. And it's a deal he does with the judge. And the policeman who is interviewed in the film, he's incredibly moved by what he's seen. He's not just an arresting officer. He's there as a spectator for something he says I'll never see again in the world. And there's a man who, I'm sure, in his daily life sees many unpleasant things as a New York policeman. And he responds rather well to seeing something beautiful. He's very moved by it. And that's, again, a very telling sort of reaction, which I don't think you get now somehow.
And didn't Philippe steal his watch?
He stole the watch of an Australian policeman who arrested him. He did another illegal, which again you glimpse in the film, in Sydney between the pillars of the Harbour Bridge, which looks over the Opera House. It's a very beautiful setting for him. And on the way down from that, he's arrested and manhandled and handcuffed, and he manages to undo his handcuffs and steal a policeman's watch. At the World Trade Center, he undoes his handcuffs very easily. And you see him in the film very happily waving his handcuffs around.
We should say for people who don't know the story, lest they think that they brought weapons with them up to the top, the bow and arrow were actually conveyances for the line that went across.
Indeed, it's something I tried to sort of not explain too much. I think it's one of those sort of discoveries you make in the film. But yes, the bow and arrow is not being used to threaten anybody. It's being used as a device to do something very clever with. And it's basically a sort of medieval idea they come up with to do something very difficult. So the bow, there's no violence or anything. I mean, Philippe doesn't even want to do violence to the building. He brings padding up there so that his cable won't mark the building. he so respects those buildings and so loves them by this time. He's been in them so often. You know, he's been sneaking in them for 8 months in New York. He's been going up the back stairway. He knows how they sound and how they breathe and how they are. And he respects them and loves them, so he doesn't want to harm them. So he brings, quite inconveniently, really, he brings padding so that his rigging won't leave any sort of mark or any sort of imprint on the top of the towers.
You said that you're terrified of heights. I'm wondering if, at any point during your relationship, Philippe tried to convince you to try balancing on a wire to see what it was like, or if you got curious enough that you would want to try that.
No, I have to say I resisted it very easily for very obvious reasons. And it was one of those things that I think he wanted the person who made the film to be suitably, you know, terrified by it. And he enjoyed it. We would go up to, sometimes we'd be in the high places, and I would just be, you know, terrified and nervous and sweaty and kind of just generally uncomfortable. And he really loved that. It was great. I couldn't be in his domain. That was the essence of it, I think. But it was all very playful, and no, I had no desire to walk on the wire, and never will have. I can say that quite categorically.
Did he worry at all about someone on the ground during any of these stunts possibly getting hurt by something that might fall?
Yeah, he's very concerned about that, but he does everything he can to plan it out and be very. He tells me, and I really believe this, that he would never ever step on any wire he wasn't sure he could reach the other side with. And that, I think, and he's very secure with his rigging, and it's done very carefully. It's a very elaborate and scientific kind of approach he has to this. So I think there is, you know, we could say objectively, of course, he could have fallen off the wire. He would never, ever, ever admit that, and would want to kind of chase me around the room again if he heard me saying it in public. But of course, we all know that to be possible. But his friend says it in the film so beautifully. He says, well, of course we knew it's possible. We didn't believe it. And he doesn't believe it either. And so we mere mortals, if you like, are able to conceive of that happening. And quite honestly, I think it was a definite possibility on that particular day, on that particular height, with the kind of unconventional wind patterns you've got. With two buildings that are very close together, they create their own kind of convection currents. So generally, it's a definite possibility that, and he says it himself, actually, he owns up to it, death is very close. But I don't think there was any danger, really, of anyone else being hurt in this, other than Philippe himself.
A reviewer in one of our local papers has called Pettit's act death-defying frivolity. Was it more than that?
I would say so. I think it's sort of magical, in a way. And I think what he does is create a sort of magical dream for people. I mean, the audience hasn't been invited. They don't know it's going to happen. It's people who are passing by. And he chose, you know, to do it in the morning for reasons of not being discovered, but also he knew there'd be lots of commuters around. In fact, you know, thousands of people actually saw this performance. And so in that respect, it's a surprise, it's a gift, and it goes away very quickly. It's like a dream. So I think it's frivolous on one level, but I think it does, you know, it's an inspiring thing too, to be able to do something like that and give it to people. So I think it's inspirational as well as frivolous.
James Marsh directed the Sundance Award-winning documentary Man on Wire. It's screening now at the Angelica Film Centers in Dallas and in Plano. James, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.